When we talk about cybersecurity, it's important to remember that it has to be adapted to the specific industry or domain that we're talking about. Now, many people who work in security in the traditional sense with financial services or healthcare organizations, if I went in and said, what are the three or four things you need to do in order to secure, protect, and lock down your environment? Many of you would say things like, we must go in and fully patch, harden, and lock down our systems. We must go in and firewall off all of our devices, and we must make sure that we're carefully monitoring all traffic coming in and out of our environment. And many people, if they saw that list, would nod and say, that's a good approach to cybersecurity. What's the problem? Well, in certain domains, like industrial control systems, that have different overall objectives, those items might not scale very well. For example, when you're talking about an industrial control system that's in a remote location and might take somebody multiple days to get there, patching can actually be one of the most dangerous, detrimental things that you can do, because patching changes a device, and to put that RTU, that remote terminal unit, in an unstable state, and then it's not able to perform the functionality that it needs. Also, putting in heavily firewalled environments can actually block critical communication that's needed, and in many cases, with control systems, integrity and availability are what's important, and confidentiality is the system's third. In most situations, if somebody is able to read or see the information coming from a control unit, that's not critical, but we need to make sure that it's received in a timely manner so proper decisions can be made and that it hasn't been altered or changed in any manner. So when we talk about ICS or industrial control system security, it changes all the rules. We often see people who have very long, effective, successful careers in traditional IT security environments, and they move over to control systems and try applying that same knowledge and principles, and it just doesn't work. We have to recognize that it's a different domain, a different problem set, and therefore we have to approach it with a different set of focus. Now, the fundamental rules of security are still the same. For example, security is and is will always be about mitigating risk to your critical assets. So the core rules of security before you spend a dollar of your budget or an hour of your time on anything in the name of security, you should still ask yourself three questions. What is the risk? Is it the highest priority risk? And is it the most cost-effective way of reducing the risk? That still applies whether we're talking about traditional IT environments or whether we're talking about control systems. However, the answers will be quite different. The risks that we might have with a financial services organization is going to be completely different than the risks that we have in control systems. Also, security is all about minimizing and reducing the risk of disclosure, alteration, and destruction to your critical information. CIA, confidentiality, integrity, and availability are the cornerstones of security. However, from a prioritization perspective, they are going to be prioritized completely different. With many organizations that are dealing with sensitive information, confidentiality is often the top priority. But as I mentioned with control systems, availability or integrity take first or second place and are much, much important than protecting disclosure of our data. So we're going to take you on a five-day journey where we're going to walk you through the necessary framework and mindset that's needed in order to protect and control our control system environment. So welcome to ICS 410, our SANS ICS SCADA Security Essentials, where we're going to go in and cover the core knowledge that's needed in order to make sure control systems are properly protected. I am Eric Cole, and I will be your instructor as we go through the next 5 days. Just a side note for our on-demand and our students that are listening to the recording, the first 18 slides of day one and the first 18 slides of day three are actually recorded separately from the rest of the course. The rest of this course was recorded at a live event, but there were some problems with the recording for the first 18 slides on day one and the first 18 slides on day three. So in order to give you the best product possible, we're re-recording these slides after the conference is over. So if you notice a slight change in the audio, that's why it's occurring, but it's not going to take away from the great content that we're delivering to you. So let's take a look at the journey that we're going to go through. We're going to take you on a five-day journey where on day one, we're going to lay the foundation. We're going to make sure that everyone understands the terminology, the concepts, and the breakdown of industrial control systems. You can't secure something you don't know about. So if we don't understand what the components are, how they work, how they interact, and how they function together, we're not going to be able to implement proper security. So day one is laying that proper foundation so we can understand the environment that we're working in. Day two is driven by a fundamental concept that offense must inform the defense. One of the big problems in security is organizations spend a lot of time, a lot of money, and a lot of energy fixing vulnerabilities. The problem, they're not the right vulnerabilities. They're not the vulnerabilities that adversaries are using to break into a system. We don't want you to do good security. We don't want you to fix good things. We want you to do the right things. And the right things are fixing the vulnerabilities in which there's a real threat vector that's used to break into our environment. Threat drives the risk calculation. Vulnerabilities drive risk reduction. Another word for threat is offense. So day two is understanding the offensive attack surface. What is it that an attacker is going to go after? How are they going to go after? And what are the methods that they're going to use to try to break into our systems? By understanding how the offense works in day two, we'll set the stage for building effective defensive measures. And that's what day three and day four is about. Once we understand the offensive mindset in day two, we're going to take that knowledge and show you how we defend control systems, servers, and workstations on day three, how we can go in and implement proper security from a control system perspective for the servers and the workstations in our environment. And day four is about defending and protecting our networks, our routers, our switches, our firewalls, all of the other devices that come into play, like data diodes and PLCs and other methods that need to be properly secure. And then once we go in and do 2 days of defending and protecting all the components, we wrap up on day five by looking at how we maintain and govern this environment and give you large amounts of resources that are needed so when you go back to work, you can directly apply this knowledge to implement effective security for your control systems. So we're excited about this course. We have great material. We have labs that we're going to work on every day to reinforce all of the core behaviors of understanding how attacks work and then building defensive measures that scale and are effective in our environment. So without any further ado, let's get started on day one. Day one, as I mentioned, is about making sure that we all have that proper foundation. Now, I always like giving a caveat. Depending on the perspective that you're coming from, some of day one might be a little bit of a review. So if you're more of a control systems engineer, then some of the concepts we're going to talk about, you're probably fairly familiar with, but we're going to be talking about it from the perspective of security, where the vulnerabilities exist, and what we need to be thinking about from a security perspective. So you'll still pick up and learn a lot of information. Others of you might be coming from a pure security background. So a lot of what we're giving you today is going to be brand new material, and it might feel a little bit like we're giving you some acronym soup with all the different acronyms, but we want to make sure that everybody taking this course is baseline and has the same knowledge of what are control systems, what are the key components of control systems, how do they work together, and what are the things that we need to be aware of from a security perspective to make sure that we're properly addressing security properly in this domain. So what we're going to cover on day one is we're going to do a little bit of history of industrial control systems. Like most things, industrial control systems have been around for a long, long time. Computers did not create the area of control systems. Computers added a new level of efficiency, a new level of risk, and a new level of exposure by adding an electronic and digital perspective, but they did not create the field of control systems. Once we understand a little bit of history, we're then going to focus in on an overview of what exactly is an industrial control system. Many people, when they think industrial control system, they instantly think utilities, oil, and gas. Now, yes, oil refineries are a great example of industrial control systems, but we can find industrial control systems in many other areas. Large e-commerce vendors have control systems for managing the manufacturing and shipping of information and packages all around the world. So while, yes, industrial control systems is heavily focused on utility companies, nuclear energy and oil and gas, we also have to remember that it does apply to many other fields and any other domains that implement and work in this space. Then we're going to go in and look at some of the different field components that are required and needed for a control system to work correctly. We'll look at some of the network components and then the communication that goes back and forth between the field and the network devices. Once again, looking at it through the lens of security. What are the things we need to be aware of that the offense will go after, and what are the things that we control and can fix from a defensive perspective? Then once we understand the field, the network components, and how they communicate together, then we're going to go in and look at the applications that sit on top of this infrastructure. And because we're all about hands-on learning, we're then going to jump into a lab where we're going to go in and get your computer set up. We're actually going to be using a Linux distro called Samurai that has a lot of the tools and techniques that we need for this class and for when you go back to work built in. And we're going to go in and give you some templates for how we start building, designing, and securing control systems. We'll then look at some of the different industry models that are out there and how they work and operate, some of the big drivers and constraints. What makes control systems different than other areas? You're going to hear me as we go through this course talk about and differentiate between control system environments and traditional IT environments, because there are unique constraints and challenges that come into play. And then, of course, when you're talking about the criticality and importance of control systems, you can't separate it from physical security, because in many cases, the physical security is just as important and critical as the cybersecurity. If you've ever gone by an oil refinery or a nuclear power plant, try getting close. Not going to happen. There's lots of physical security. There's guards. There's guns. There's fences. So that plays a critical role. And one of the big drivers where we're talking about control systems in certain industries, especially utility, and especially in the nuclear arena, is it's all about personal safety, making sure that these systems are operating in a safe environment to minimize any loss of human life if there was a problem or an issue. So you're going to notice that in certain domains, when we talk control systems, we immediately talk about the safety and the loss of life perspective, because they're so closely intertwined. So now that we've looked at the outline for what we're going to be covering on day one, let's go ahead and look at what exactly do we mean when we say industrial control systems, and what are some historical examples that we can look at. At the most basic level, when we say the phrase industrial control system, what we're really talking about is a set of devices in which is heating, air conditioning, and ventilation, the HVAC system, in your room. If I walk in to this room and it is cold, what am I going to do? I'm going to go over to the thermostat and I'm going to adjust the thermostat. I'm going to hit the little red arrow and I'm going to crank that number up. Now, when I crank that number up, what does that thermostat do? It's going to go out to one of the sensors in the room and say, what is the current temperature in the room? It's then going to do logic decision and say, okay, the current temperature in the room is lower than the desired temperature. So it's then going to make a decision where it's then going to go and send information to turn on the heater and have the heater generate heat into that room. Then as the heat is being generated, it will continue to receive information from those remote sensors. And when those remote sensors tell the thermostat that it is now equal to the desired temperature, it will then go in and shut off the heater. Now, anyone who works in HVAC knows there's more complexity to that. I am oversimplifying it a little, but I'm trying to make the point that a control system is exactly what I just described. You have sensors that provide information back to a decision support unit, and that decision support unit then controls and monitors other equipment or field devices to perform certain actions or to perform certain activity. So an industrial control system has many components, many field devices, and there is decision made to control and operate how those devices function. And as I was getting ready to teach this course, I just started thinking about all the different control systems that we come across every single day and don't even realize it. I introduced one control system, which of course is our thermostat in the room. What about when you turn on your faucet and you need to adjust the water? What about when you get in your car and you press the accelerator? There are control systems all around us, so this models how the real world operates and how the real world functions. Now, of course, in the beginning of this course, I'm talking about smaller scale control systems, but we could also have much larger control systems like an oil refinery plant. So as I mentioned, control systems were not created with the advent of computers. Control systems have been around for a long, long time. Computers just helped optimize, increase the scalability, and in some cases, increase the overall risk. But we've been using control systems for as long as we've been doing any major functionality. Agricultural work is a good example of what's shown in this example. So if we look at a few historical examples, the first one is the Siebo's water clock. This was created 2000 BC, and it turns out that by going in and measuring the flow of water, you can use it to tell time, because water flows at a constant rate. So by making a hole of a certain size, the amount of water that can flow through is indicative to a certain period of time. Based on the size of the hole, X amount of water would flow through in X amount of seconds. So by understanding that flow, we can actually go in and use that to be able to tell time. Very basic control system, but a control system nonetheless. The next one is dancing automaters, which some of you might have had as kids growing up, or you might have got for your children. But essentially, this is a fairly complex toy that when you wind it up, will perform certain activity and certain movement and behave in a certain manner. Once again, very, very, very simple examples, but still control systems nonetheless. Then we have the furnace thermostat, in which I talked about, where you could go in and be able to adjust the temperature in a room to be able to adapt to the current temperature and either add heating or add cooling, as I showed in my example. And then the final example is the fly ball governor that was invented in 1788 with steam engines. And this was very, very significant, because prior to the fly ball governor, if you wanted the steam engine to move or go forward, you had to apply steam. And then when it was going too fast, you would have to turn off the steam. So imagine a car where you're constantly gassing, braking. That would not be an efficient way. So the flyball governor allowed the engine to operate at a consistent level and be able to control the speed faster or slower without having to turn on and turn off the input on the steam. So this was significant, because this allowed a lot more efficiencies in how engines could operate and engines can function. Now, when we start moving from some of these fairly basic examples, and we start getting a little more modernish from a control system perspective, we start off with our automated pneumatic systems. These systems really lacked any information about any other systems. There wasn't really any processing or capability going on, sort of independent controls. And then when we looked at some of the early relays, these early relays were very cumbersome, expensive, difficult to configure. And based on some of the early work with relays led to a lot of the work that we have on our PLCs that we'll talk about a little later on in the course. So when we go in and we're looking at control system, we have this idea of a loop, where we're going through a constant analysis process and making adjustments on the fly. So in order to show you the different factors that are in place, you have the process value, which is what the current value is. The set point is what the desired value is. The manipulated variable is what you're changing, and the error is what's the difference between the process value and the set point. To show you how these work, let's look at a faucet. Tonight, when you go home, before you go to sleep, you're going to want to wash up. So you go in and you turn on the water faucet and you put your hand under and feel the water. That is the process value. That is the current process value. And let's assume that it is cold. You desire hot water. That's the set point. The manipulated variables is you're going to go in and turn more of the hot water onto the faucet. And the error is the difference between what you desire, the set point, and what the current value is. Then, when you're feeling the water and it gets to the temperature you want, when the error becomes zero, you then stop or lock in those faucets, which are the manipulated variables, and you go in and wash up before bed. So those are the basic factors that come into play when we're dealing with control loops, is what is the current value? What is the desired value? What is the error, the difference between them, and what can we manipulate to get that error to close to zero as possible? And a lot of this is optimized through the use of proportional integral derivatives. So when we go in and look at a PID, which is proportional integral derivatives, the formal definition is proportional is what is the current error value. Integral is what is the duration of the error. And the derivative is what is the slope of the error multiplied by the derivative. Now, the way I always look at this is fairly simple. The proportional is what is the current state. The integral is what is the historical or previous state. And the derivative is what is the prediction of the future state. So what we're really doing when we talk about PID controller theory is we're looking at the current state with the perspective of the history and the future state that we're combining together. This allows us to be able to optimize the overall tuning. So the proportional is the current error. The integral is the historical or previous or duration of the error. And the derivative is a prediction of the future error. And we all use that to control the desired output. Another concept that comes into play when we talk about control systems is fuzzy logic. What fuzzy logic does is it allows us to represent things in a natural language format. Traditional computers are exact devices. It is 78 degrees. It is 80 degrees. It is 85 degrees. The problem is that's not how humans operate. You do not walk into a room and say, it is currently 78 degrees. I desire it to be 72 degrees. We're not robots. That's not how we operate. What do? We walk in a room and say, it is too hot, it is too cold, or it is just right. Those are fuzzy values. They are not exact values like a zero or a one that a computer operates in. So what we do with fuzzy logic is we now can go in and we can take a natural language and convert it to a computer language so we can now represent degrees of truth. So this slide sort of shows you that instead of the traditional on or off, zero or one, we now can have degrees. We're going from cold to warm to hot, which is a natural language that is more how humans operate and function, which allows computers to better interact and work with us to control and monitor how those systems function. So now that we've gone in and we've looked at some of the different technologies that's out there, we've seen how technological advances are allowing our systems to be able to get a lot more complex and a lot more granular. Let's go in and do an overview of some of the objectives the types of systems and the roles and responsibilities that are out there. When we look at the type of control systems, the whole idea is to go in and automate and get more things done by the computer with less work by people. The whole idea of a control system is to increase the efficiency and increase the automation so you have less humans involved and less manual tasks and much more automation in order to get things done in a more efficient manner. Now, you're always going to have a human in the loop at some point, but we ultimately want to minimize that as much as possible and automate the process so we can be more efficient in how it operates and functions. So when we look at some of the types of control systems, here's where we get a little bit into some of the acronym soup. We have our distributed control system, our process control system, our energy management system, our building management system, our safety instrumented system, our SCADA, supervisory control, and data acquisition. We also get into factory automation, manufacturing and execution systems, protection and control, instrumentation and control, and as I mentioned, we also have one of the key components of control systems, which is programmable logic controllers.
So one of the areas we talked about before break, and I got a few questions on, so I just want to make sure we're all on the same page, that when we're deploying and creating industrial control systems, the three main goals that we're typically after is minimizing human interaction, efficiency is being able to do things quicker and faster, and cost savings, being able to do things in a cheaper manner. So when we design our security solutions, we need to make sure that we're not interrupting any of those three core areas. Because if we have a great security solution, but it requires a lot more human interaction, or it's less efficient, or it's very, very expensive, most likely it's not going to get approved. Because the whole reason for deploying these control systems was to accomplish those three goals. So our security needs to complement, minimize humans, increase efficiency, and reduce cost savings are going to be the three areas you have to be very, very careful on when recommending solutions. And most of the time, when I come in and help out our utility clients, and the security folks are so frustrated saying, the executives are not giving us the resources, no one's listening to us, no one's helping us, and I look at their solutions, in almost all cases, I say, well, the problem is that solution is very manually intensive, that solution is very inefficient, and that solution is very expensive. So let's figure out a new solution that doesn't have any of those areas that contradict the primary goals of rolling out the control systems in the first place. So we then talk about some of these different areas. DCS, which is going to be our distributed control system, these were introduced about 40 years ago. And typically, they were designed to being able to deal with systems that are geographically dispersed at many different areas or locations. The important thing to remember about DCS, because of when they were designed and built, they rely very heavily on proprietary protocols and proprietary devices. They're not necessarily using open industry standards. Now, the thing we have to immediately remember when we're talking about proprietary is proprietary should be synonymous with vendor. That means you're at the vendor's mercy in terms of controlling, implementing security. Because I'll tell you right now, if you're using a proprietary protocol, unless you deal directly with the vendor, you're not going to be able to change, alter, or modify. Now, we do get into this later in the week, and Graham can definitely jump in on this area, but it always amazes me. So many people who work in utilities with control systems, they're afraid of the vendors. I'm like, have you talked to the vendors? And they're like, no. Vendors are very nice people. The vendors want to help you. And you know what the number one complaint I get from vendors are? Our customers are not calling us. We can't help them if we don't know where the problem is. A vendor came up to me yesterday and says, Eric, when you do incident response with control systems, how many times do the customer allow you to call the vendor, interact with the vendor, or notify the vendor? Zero. They don't let me go there. And they said, but Eric, how can we fix issues and increase security if they're not telling us where the problems and where the issues are? So I don't know where this misconception came into play that vendors are evil and bad and should not be talked to. But in most cases, they'll give you free resources. They'll help you. They'll provide advice. They'll provide guidance. So this concept of not talking to the vendors, I personally would throw that book out and create a new one. Call them, interact with them, work with them. If you don't believe me, look at that face. Isn't it? Look at Graham's face. I mean, he's an honest, nice guy. I mean, come on. Don't you want to talk to him and have him help you out in your different areas? So one of the themes we'll talk about is the more you're dealing with these proprietary systems, which are very prevalent in ICS land, you need to have a very close relationship with the vendors, not an adverse, because in most cases, the vendors can help you solve your problems and will make things a lot easier and quicker for you. So especially when we get into the proprietary nature of DCS systems, interaction with vendors is an important thing to do. Now, when we look at any of our systems, and we'll cover this later, we always want to go in and create what we call our zones or segments, because we need to be able to allow information to flow between trust levels, but we want to carefully control and monitor information between different trust levels. So as we're designing our security, one of the first things we always want to do is look at an accurate representation of our environment and start drawing these circles around the trust levels and zones that are in place within our environment. At a most basic level with DCS, you essentially have your three main levels. We're going to add to this later on. We're going to get to five. But right now, the three primary levels is your business. This is where you're running your typical application servers, DNS servers, infrastructure, business. You then have the supervisory level, which is the control system that are making the decisions. And then you have the field level, which is where all your sensors and devices come into play. So essentially, your field devices are going to provide information to the supervisory level. The supervisory level is going to make decisions and push it back down to the devices to control and manage how they operate and function. And then the business level is going to oversee the organization from a payment functionality and infrastructure perspective. So when we get into our distributed control systems, we basically have our three basic levels, our field devices, our supervisory, and our business. And from a security perspective, typically this supervisory level is going to be fairly isolated. So other than humans inadvertently bringing in USB, DVDs, or others, typically direct attack vectors are fairly minimal. However, they're connected to the business unit, which often has internet access, which can be an attack vector. But honestly, more and more, we're seeing attackers go after the easier area, which are the field devices. Most organizations have spent considerable amount of time on securing their internet connections. So honestly, that attack vector is somewhat hard. Most of the field devices haven't been updated, protected, or a lot of security. So we're seeing a lot of attack vectors going across here, not only as an entry point into the environment, but we're also seeing in certain third world countries, the equipment at these devices are expensive and can be sold on the black market for a lot of money. So we're just seeing good old-fashioned petty theft of why rob a convenience store when you can rob a field unit and be able to get $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for it on the black market. So many reasons why the field devices are becoming that primary target from an attack vector perspective. Then we have our PCS, which is our process control system. This is typically meant to control and manage processes in a limited area. So typically the big factor of DCS is large, distributed, and remote locations. PCSs are typically what you're going to run in that single location. So everything is fairly close regional where you're getting information and details in a localized environment. So one of the questions we got is, what type of systems are used in a typical electrical utility company? And the answer is yes. All of these, right? So at your local processing plant, you're going to have a lot of process control systems monitoring the local processing at that plant. But you're also going to go in and have a SCADA environment because you're going to have a lot of distributed areas where you have sensors, and you might have to go in and actually buy usage from other areas if your current clientele is overutilizing the production capabilities of your primary plant. So you're going to have a lot of distributed communication between those different locations. So it's a SCADA environment, but then it has PCS in the local areas. And then, of course, because we're dealing with large-scale electrical production, there's, of course, going to be safety issues. So you're going to have a safety instrumented system to monitor and control from a fault level to minimize any impact. So when you start looking at it, you have all of these interact together as opposed to individual isolated components. Then your EMS is going to go in, and that's going to be your energy management system. That's typically what you go and find in buildings to sort of operate and optimize the production of the usage within your environment. EMS systems are often a subset of supervisory control and data acquisition systems. So you might hear some people out in the field refer to these as EMS SCADA or SCADA EMS systems, because the SCADA is the large-scale supervisory control data acquisition systems in which the EMS, the energy management system, is a component to control and manage the running of those generation capabilities within that utility company. Then, of course, we have SCADA, which is supervisory control and data acquisition system. It differs from other industrial control systems based on the fact that it's typically large-scale processes across multiple sites, large geographic areas. If you look at a typical electrical utility company, you're going to have multiple generation plants that are all interacting, working with the clientele that's going to ultimately utilize what's generated, and therefore that is a perfect example of a SCADA system, large scale, geographically dispersed area that has coordination across all of those different areas. And as I mentioned, as microprocessor systems continue to reduce, the difference between DCS and SCADA are sort of coming less and less clear in terms of the differentiations. And most people today typically are referring to SCADA. So you're seeing DCS almost start to be an expired term, where SCADA is the more common terminology in place. But remember, SCADA is just one type of ICS. A lot of people use them interchangeably, but there's a lot more to ICS besides SCADA. PLCs are ICS, which is a subcomponent of SCADA, but not in itself SCADA by itself. So it's a type of industrial control system, typically large-scale, utility, water, nuclear-style environments. So if you look at the basic breakdown of our supervisory control and data acquisition systems, you're going to go in and have your control center. You're going to have your remote field units. But notice the big difference in this diagram versus our DCS is we're going to have a wide area network communication between all of those. Typically, if we go back 15, 20 years ago, a lot of it was actual wires. You had switch telephone, lease lines, or others. As you can imagine, that's very expensive, very hard to maintain, very easy for it to break, issues, problems if they're doing construction in certain areas. So we've started moving to satellite. Satellite works well, but is very, very expensive in terms of its operation. And then, of course, we're now seeing a lot more cellular, wireless, radio frequency. And what's nice about the cellular capabilities is you can actually go in and set up the cellular network in a way that you're actually doing point-to-point verification of that service. So it's not like a cell phone where I can call any number from any location. You can actually go in and do isolated restricted cell service where we literally can say this device at location A can only make cellular calls to this device at location B. Now, I can't tell you 100% secure because anyone who's telling you that is lying. Like, there's always ways to defeat or get around security, but going in and doing point-to-point cellular is a heck of a lot more secure than open, unrestricted wireless. So there's starting to be ways that we can better restrict and limit the exposure factor, but this is really the key area of SCADA that you focus on, that communication channel. Because you still have the exposure of your field devices, the control units are often isolated. It's that communication channel that often is the exposure factor that attackers are going to go after. Other thing that we'll cover a little later today is when, look at this environment. Look at the control center receiving and pushing information back and forth to those field sites. From a pure play security perspective, what is our primary concern factor here? Depending on who you talk to, we often get into heated arguments in control systems, whether availability or integrity are the highest priority items. I sort of, me and a Mike, we get along very well because we're integrity guys. My argument is if that information is falsified, not accurate, that's actually worse than if the components are down, because if the components are down, you visibly know that you have an issue. If somebody's altering or monitoring information, then you don't even know it, which can cause longer-term attack. But then we have some of our other smarter colleagues that will argue that availability is critical, because if you're not even receiving the data, then who even cares about the integrity component of that information? But notice, no one's arguing the confidentiality piece. No one's saying that that data ultimately needs to be encrypted or protected. And the reason I bring that up is if we were talking about a bank and we were doing remote communication with the different localized branches, what would be the primary argument? Confidentiality, confidentiality, confidentiality. So typically in traditional IT environments, we're always arguing the confidentiality of that data. However, when we get into control systems, it's much more about the integrity and availability as opposed to the confidentiality. Because honestly, I don't care if you see my information. I just want to make sure I receive it and you can't alter it. So we often switch to what we call that CIA triad, confidentiality, integrity, availability, upside down when we're dealing in control systems. We often, if we say integrity, we're often talking about the data itself. But you're right, in a lot of these cases, it's not the data per se, it's the accuracy of the configuration of those devices. In a lot of cases, if this remote terminal unit is accurately configured and I can do a verifiable check on it and system acceptance testing before it goes live, and I can do full verification of the router's receive points, then we have a high level of validation that the information that's going across is accurate there. So you're right, it's the technical integrity of those devices, because many people from vendors to field technicians have access to these field devices. These field devices do change periodically, and depending on environmental conditions, other locations, you might be altering or changing some of the set values, as you mentioned. So you're right. When we say integrity, we have to make sure that we're applying it to the domain in which we're talking about. So you're absolutely right. Technical integrity of the device to make sure the accuracy of the configuration parameters are correct is exactly what we're talking about. So excellent, excellent clarification. Then if we look at a real world example, we actually have something in the United States called MISO, which is the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators. And essentially, it's a non-profit organization that's a wholesaler for electricity within the United States. So essentially, MISO doesn't actually generate any power. They just go in and coordinate across the United States and even part of Canada to be able to go in. And if you have one area that's overproducing and another area that's underproducing, it can actually go in and be able to move the utilization that's required in order to make sure that the proper power is in the right areas or right regions at any given time or any given location. Now, this is when we start talking about security, always starts getting everyone a little nervous, because what you're in essence doing with MISO or MISO, depending on how you pronounce it, is you're now taking all these independent power companies and you're now interconnecting them together. So now they're actually sharing, coordinating, and having access to all these different systems. So now think from an exposure perspective. If you're an adversary and you want to break in, you look at this chart and say, okay, which one of these utility companies has the weakest link, the lowest level of security, or the minimal amount of protection? And that's what I'm going to go after. And then when I break in, I could go in and be able to ride across the rest of that network from an exposure or compromise perspective. So the thing we have to remember is, if you ask me to pick one technology theme that I see occurring across control systems, the number one theme I would mention is interconnectivity. We are seeing a lot more of these devices that were built for availability and uptime that were never ever meant for interconnectivity or exposure. And we're seeing a lot more areas, both within country and across country, of having lots more interconnectivity between it. And now we have to be real concerned, because you are only as secure as your weakest link. So now if you're part of the Mid-Continent Independent System Operators, which coordinates electrical utilization across the different areas, you now have to make sure that your control separation is proper, that if somebody breaks into one utility, it doesn't negatively impact your security.